everyone. Our first case this morning is State v. Swanson. Mr. Pivovar, good morning to you.
Good morning, Judge. May it please the court, my name is Greg Pivovar, court appointing counsel for Roger Swanson. Mr. Swanson was convicted of first degree sexual assault on a child. The victim in this case basically testified four times in this case. She did three interviews with Project Harmony, and she testified in court. The Project Harmony videos were all allowed into evidence, and they were widely disparate and widely disparate with her testimony in court. Her first interview in 2014, she was born in 2005. The alleged incidents occurred either when she was 3, 4, or 5, depending on which version of the statements you go along with.
How old was she when she testified in court?
2005, it was the beginning of 2018, so she was 12 and a half, I believe, at the time. During the, her first interview was in 2014, where she interviewed and said that she can't remember being touched. She was never hurt by this individual. Never got naked. She was kissed on the cheek, and she sat on his lap. The next interview occurred later in 2014. There she indicated she was in kindergarten when the incidents occurred, which would have been roughly the fall of 2000, I believe the testimony came out the fall of 2010. She remembers at that time that specifically that her mother was trading her off for drugs, and that was her testimony. The third interview came quite a while later, April of 2016, so it would have been about halfway between the first two interviews and her her testimony in court. She again gave a different version of the facts and was somewhat confused about other abusive situations that took place against her. At trial testimony, she indicated that, again, that this was a drugs for sex trade by her mother, and she was basically being used. The interesting thing that comes out at trial is the testimony of the defendant. The defendant's a 65-year-old man. Has virtually no record. He had a DUI in his past and two bad check charges. He testified that he'd never done drugs in his life, that he had never sold drugs in his life, never handled drugs in his life. He had gotten, separated from his wife because of her drug use. And when he found out that the victim's mother was using drugs, he distanced himself from her. There was no testimony of any kind from anyone during the entire trial that anyone had ever seen Mr. Swanson use drugs, that they had ever, that he had ever been involved in any way in drug trade.
What was the testimony of the victim with respect to drugs?
Her testimony at trial was that she knew that there were drugs being exchanged and that her mother was a drug user. I think she testified there might have been a pipe present during one of the incidents, or alleged incidents.
Was all the information you just provided us in the beginning of your argument today, was that all presented to the jury?
Yes. Sorry. The jury was able to view all of the Project Harmony videos. They were, all three were admitted into evidence, no objection. And then the testimony of the young lady pretty much was consistent that that drugs were involved in this.
So these are credibility issues before
the jury?
They are
credibility issues. And I understand the standard. I understand that, that it's a hard burden to overcome. It's just such a odd case that the jury, faced with all of these wide variety of stories, chose to believe the one that they did and convict him. He had absolutely no record at the time except the DUI. He'd lived 65 years. He'd been a productive member of society. He'd worked the whole time. The other testimony that came out at trial that's interesting is his testimony that he left Nebraska for Colorado to live with his son in 2010, in April of 2010, and was consistently out of the state for the next 5 years. Matches nowhere with the victim's testimony. The victim, again, depending on which version you take, varies from being 3 years old to 5 years old when it happens. But what she was pretty consistent about was that it occurred when she was in kindergarten, a time when she was living with her foster parents at the time, who eventually became her adoptive parents. And then she would see her mother on weekends. Doesn't match with anything else, and then there's no contra testimony to the defendant's statement that he was out of state the entire time. There was only one other witness called on behalf of the defense, and he gave some testimony. One, that the defendant, he'd known him for 35 years, never seen a drug around him, and had heard him disparage the use of drugs.
Mr. Pivovar, you acknowledge the difficulty of the standard that we typically apply in cases of this sort involving credibility. Are you asking us to change our jurisprudence on those issues? I'm a little perplexed at the path that you're suggesting that we take. If we do not change our jurisprudence, how would we write the opinion to be consistent with it? And if we do change our jurisprudence, how would we write the principle so that we aren't becoming some sort of super jury?
That's what I got.
I understand. I imply no criticism at all. I understand what the difficult burden. I'm just struggling with what exactly you want us to do.
I guess there are just some cases that I think come before the court that are incredible, and I don't know how you handle it. There seems that there needs to be some kind of, this is incredible, we can't even buy this. It's easier to do it the way the court does it, but And it's been consistent. When I first started arguing down here, there was a little more of a loose standard.
The accused rule kept popping up from time to time.
Yeah. And that, you know, as a defense attorney, that's the rule I'd love to have back. But we don't right now. And I guess I'm arguing for an incredible rule this time, because that's what I have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee in the state of Nebraska. Appellant argues the evidence was insufficient to support his convictions and also raises challenges to the sentence he received. The state believes the evidence, when viewed in the light most favorable to the state, was sufficient to support the convictions, that the district court did not abuse its discretion in the sentence imposed, nor did the sentence imposed violate appellant's constitutional rights, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
If we were inclined to retreat from the credibility articulation that we have repeatedly articulated for a number of years, and I realize you don't want us to do that.
That's correct.
How would we conceivably do it?
I really am not sure that there would be a good way to do so, because in particular in this case, this court has the interviews, but this court, regarding the testimony at trial, has only what we have on appeal, which is the written record of what occurred. So this court, and I think that's why that jurisprudence sort of developed, is that this court recognized that the finder of fact is the one who, in most cases, when there is in-person testimony, is able to watch the witnesses, to hear voice intonations and facial expressions, and to make a determination about who the fact finder thinks is more credible. So I really am not sure how this court would be able to make the same determination, because this court would have different information before it than the finder of fact at the trial level.
What is in the record corroborating the victim's testimony?
Well, I think the victim first stated that, yes, well, in one of the interviews she stated that it was in kindergarten. At trial she said, I had my dates mixed up, and it was when we were living in a house on Nicholas Street in Omaha. And the now adopted mother of the victim testified that beginning in maybe around 2008, the victim and her biological mother were living at a home in Omaha on Nicholas Street. The defendant himself testified that he used to go to the home, visit the victim and her mother at that home. Regarding the actual acts that occurred, the first-degree sexual assault and the third-degree sexual assault, the testimony of the victim is what establishes that. But Nebraska Revised Statutes Chapter 29, Section 2028, states that the testimony of the victim is sufficient in a first-degree sexual assault case. And this court has recognized that it, if believed by the finder of fact, is sufficient to establish the elements of the crime. So in this case, for the actual first-degree sexual assault acts, aside from age and location and time frame, it is the victim's testimony that establishes those.
Perhaps I should have asked your opponent this question, but I'm going to ask you since he ran out of time. To what extent was an alternative theory of a different perpetrator presented to the jury?
It was presented, Your Honor. In the first interview that the victim gave, there were two men she described as being in her life, and they both happened to have names beginning with R. And partway through the interview, and I don't recall the exact point in the interview, but my recollection of that interview is that the interviewer said, okay, well, I want to make sure I've got what you're telling me correct. And she said, gentleman A was bad and hurt you, and defendant was good. And the victim said, no, 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 that's wrong. Defendant was the one who hurt me, and the other man was good. And from that point on, the victim was consistent with that it was the appellant. At trial, she stated it was the appellant, she was certain it was the appellant, and that there was no way she was confusing the appellant for someone else.
Was there circumstantial evidence presented regarding the alternative perpetrator theory? Where that person was, timing, those sorts of things?
Your Honor, I don't recall. It's been a while since I've looked at the record. I don't recall that that was there. It could have been. But I just don't recall at this time. Regarding the sufficiency of the evidence argument, appellant's argument, as this court has discussed with both of us, is essentially an attack on the credibility of the victim. Differences between her statements in the interviews and the statements at or her testimony at trial. But the jury watched the interviews. The jury saw the victim testify and saw the appellant testify. The jury was aware of these issues and still found the victim to be the more credible witness as they convicted appellant of these charges. An appellant is asking this court to find that the victim was not credible, which this court's current standard of review, that I hope will be the same standard, is that this court does not pass on the credibility of witnesses or reweigh the evidence. The standard is, was there evidence, any evidence to support the elements of the crime? And the state submits to you that here there were the evidence was sufficient to support the convictions.
Was the victim's testimony, as between the interviews and at trial, was it contradictory or was it more expansive? How would you characterize the sort of progression of the...
I think it was more expansive. There were times where, you know, she said some things, you know, for example, in the one interview she said this was in kindergarten, and then later she said, no, that was wrong, it was before kindergarten. And the victim was asked about that, and she specifically actually described how she thought that she did in the interview. She said, the first interview, I was kind of overwhelmed, I didn't understand why they wanted all this information, and I was scared that I was going to be, that I was going to see my biological mother again. She said the second interview, she thought she didn't do much better, that she was still, she wasn't ready to tell the whole story, and that by the third interview, she thought she did a good job of staying on task and on topic and giving more details. So again, it kind of goes back to the jury was aware of these issues with her previous statements and her testimony at trial and still found that her trial testimony was credible. Very briefly, appellant raises an as-applied constitutional challenge to the sentence he received, but he did not file a notice pursuant to Nebraska Court Rules of Appellate Practice 2109E and has not preserved that for appeal. Very briefly, the state does not believe that the sentence imposed, which was within the statutory limits, was a violation of the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment, nor do we believe that the sentence imposed was an abuse of discretion.
When did the defendant's challenge to the mandatory minimum enter the case?
Your Honor, I believe it was in brief on appeal. I could be incorrect, and if I am, then it was, I don't believe it was raised before the trial court, but even if it was not, a notice was not filed, and so it would not have been preserved for this court. Unless this court has additional questions, we request you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Pivovar, thank you for your service. The next case of the day is Jones versus Jones.